I am Charles Evans. I am honored to deliver Rabbi Silver's sermon in his behalf. Every holiday has an enemy. The enemy of Yom Kippur is pride. What has pride to do with these magnificent, well-written prayers of our liturgy, or with the magnificent minor keyed melodies we have heard, or the rite of fasting? These prayers have no meaning unless they are prayers, unless they express that which is deep within, and the music has no significance unless it touches our hearts and helps us toward repentance and atonement. The rite of fasting is no more than a crash diet unless we understand its spiritual significance. There are some who recite every Yom Kippur the litany of confession, but fail to see that every item contained in it applies to their own lives. Some leave the synagogue after Ne'ilah exactly as they entered for the Kol Nidre, appreciative of a grand and glorious experience by rabbi, choir, and congregation, but not one whit the better for it as human beings. What blinds us to the fact that we are the principal actor in this drama of Yom Kippur, that our prayers are not set speeches by some master playwright, but the speeches of our own heart, which should be coursing within and disturbing us during the meditation of this day? What is it that blinds us to the meaning of Yom Kippur in our own lives? Pride, false pride. The coronation of the emperors of the Austro-Hungarian Empire took place in Vienna in the Cathedral of St. Stephen. This magnificent religious building was a fitting place for a royal ascension. But before the emperor designate was allowed to enter the cathedral for coronation, there was but one ritual he had to undertake. As he approached the gates, he found them locked. The emperor was obliged to summon a church attendant and to cry out, "I, Emperor Franz Joseph of all Austria-Hungary, demand admittance." The canon replied, "We do not know the emperor of all Austria-Hungary. Who is it who desires admittance?" The emperor called out, "I, Franz Joseph, I demand admittance." And again the answer came, "We do not know, Franz Joseph, who is it who demands admittance?" A third time the emperor cried out, but this time his words were of a different tone. "I, a sinner, request admittance." "Permission is granted. Enter, sinner, thou art known to us." The purpose of this ritual is self-evident. Here was a man who had the power of life and death over millions of subjects. The future of his people would rest entirely upon his shoulders, and only a man who was conscious of his limitations, of his frailties, of his folly, who was willing to listen and to reason, only such a man was fit to rule. The rite was well and beautifully conceived, but one wonders in what spirit the emperor designate spoke those words. Did he really think of himself on the morning of his coronation as a sinner? When the streets of Vienna rang with praise, did he have the vision to listen to the still small voice within saying, "Thou art but a man, no more. Though thou be king, thou art mortal. Though thou be emperor, thou wilt make mistakes"? Indeed, if one picks up the chapter book of the canon of the Cathedral of St. Stephen, one can read opposite the description of a coronation these words by a pious prelate, "Would that the heart heard that which the mouth has spoken." Many of us, I am afraid, undertake Yom Kippur in much the same spirit in which the emperors of Austria undertook this rite. When we are full of the surge of youth, or flushed with success, surrounded by friends who are full of respect, when the world paints a glamorous picture of us, we have little patience with a more carefully drawn picture which shows the sags of weakness, the lines of ineffectuality. We want to be told that we are beyond the ordinary foibles. When we are full of pride, we are empty of humility, empty of the contrition which enables us to see that the litany speaks of us, our failings, our compromises, our faults. The pompous egocentric must always remain a spectator at his own Yom Kippur. Surely, the ritual speaks of someone else's faults, not his. Pride is the enemy of Yom Kippur, and pride is the enemy of faith. An 18th century Hasid was once asked by a disciple where God dwells. He might have answered, God dwells in the beauty of nature, or in the history of human progress, or that God dwells in the spark of divinity that is in every man. God dwells everywhere. The Hasidic answer was otherwise. God dwells wherever man lets him in. There is truth to this answer, for we come to belief not solely or even primarily through premise and conclusion. We come to faith by confronting the illimitable expanse of the universe, the mystery of life, the miracle of love, by confronting the fact that we are mortal, small, and that the universe is vast. We are surrounded by unlimited power. Our talents are God-given, given by someone beyond ourselves. We live in a world of wonder, and when we stand in fascination and awe before that world, then faith moves within us. Awe and wonder are the seeds of faith. God dwells wherever man lets him in. The man who is full of himself has no room for God. One man looks at his family and he says, how fortunate I am to be surrounded by such love. As he meditates on the miracle of love and the mystery of life, he is led to God. Another man looks at his family and says, how fortunate they are that I am their protector and provider. His thoughts describe a narrow circle of which he is hub and center. He begins and he ends with himself. His thoughts can never extend beyond that circle. He confronts only himself. One man looks at his talents and blesses God for those talents. He looks at his station and he blesses his parents' training, his teachers' understanding, the healing of physicians, and all those strangers who brought into being by their sacrifices the freedom and the prosperity which he enjoys. Another man looks at his talents and prides himself upon having disciplined these talents. He looks at his station and he prides himself. All that I have, all that I am, I have achieved for myself. His thoughts begin and end with himself. The British Prime Minister Benjamin Disraeli reported that the thing of which he was most proud was that he was a self-made man. Critics added that he worshiped his maker. When we are filled with pride, we are not inclined to bow before God. When we are full of ourselves, we are empty of God, for we can see only our handiwork, our achievement, our glory. The vast glories of God pale into insignificance. We have no eyes to see them, and we do not see them. The observation that faith is the enemy, that pride is the enemy of faith, can help us understand much of the dimensions of faith in our own day. Social critics and social historians have pointed out that our faith is by and large tepid, uncertain, and unsure. True, we believe that faith is a good thing. We send our children to religious schools to learn faith. They listen respectfully. But somehow many cannot hold fast to a strong, vital faith, a faith which gives us power and comfort and courage, Why not? Why is our faith so lukewarm and uncertain? Are we militantly atheistic? No. Atheism is not the dimension of our age. Ours is an age of religious revival. Are we indifferent to faith? No. If we were indifferent, we would not join the churches and the synagogues that we do join. Why then are we uncertain in our faith? The usual answer has been that the content of modern learning has sapped the foundations of faith. The revolution of learning in the past 100 years has replaced all the axioms of physics, biology, philosophy, psychology by new discoveries. It seems that these new discoveries undermine all that was once held sacred. I do not believe this to be so. Faith, belief in God, is no more disproven today than in any earlier century. Indeed, the ship of faith sails on as serenely in the sea of modern knowledge as it did on the ancient ocean of wisdom. True, science has scraped from the ship of faith many a barnacle of superstition. It is no longer possible for men to believe that Adam was created on the sixth day, or that there was a flood which covered the world for 40 days and 40 nights, or that God has invested in any one synagogue or church infallible knowledge. The ancients, at least the more brilliant of them, knew long ago that much that we now challenge in the name of science was only a myth and was not to be taken literally. Where does faith begin? Faith begins with wonder. Is our world any less full of wonder? Those who work at the outposts of knowledge, who search to bring light into these dark recesses, these are the men and women of faith of our day. They sense the freshness and the force of the world over which we have little control, the world whose dimensions defy description, the world of God, the world whose glory we can hardly describe. No, it is not the content of our modern knowledge which has undermined the substance of our faith. What then has happened? For clearly, our faith is uncertain. The answer, I believe, is our vanity. When man looks at the heavens, what does he see? The silver trail of satellites coursing round our world. Man looks at this world, what does he see? Towering cities, giant industry, bridges spanning the wide rivers. Wherever man looks, he sees evidence of his own handiwork. We are a proud age and have reason to be proud. No age heretofore has achieved as greatly in engineering and technology. We are proud of our accomplishments, but our accomplishments have caused us to lose perspective. Look to the heavens and see who has created these. What heavens are we looking at? The limited heavens surrounded by the satellites and Sputniks? Or the heaven which is infinitely expanding, which is contained only in God? And what do we look for on the earth? Is it for harmony of sky and soil and sea and air, which creates life and permits life, the beauty of the landscape? Or is it for evidence of the civilizations which man has been able to build upon this landscape? You must see both, but you must see both in perspective. You must see not only our human handiwork, but the handiwork of God. To see and recognize this, I firmly believe, is to have faith. Pride is the enemy of God, whether it be the pride of the individual or the pride of the race. Only a race or an individual humble enough to see himself in true perspective can accept God and live by his law. Pride is the enemy of God. Pride is the enemy of man. Pride is the enemy of Yom Kippur. Pride destroys love. What is love but a sharing of life's beauty? What does a beloved say? My beloved is mine, and I am my beloved's. What does the prideful man say? Love is a conquest. My beloved is mine. He cannot bring himself to say, I am my beloved's. Pride is the enemy of love because pride destroys sensitivity, our ability to share. Love cannot long survive when men and women lack the capacity to share life's beauties. Pride is the enemy of friendship. How long can you sustain a friendship if your friend only asks for your attention to gratify his own vanity? He wants your applause, your approbation. He will not listen to your criticism, nor to your reason. He wants you for selfish reasons, and once you cease to gratify his whim, he will pass you over for someone who knows better how to flatter him and how to gratify him. Pride destroys love, pride destroys friendship, and pride destroys compassion, those tender shoots which go out from us and permit us to relate to the world about us. Of what is compassion born? Of a recognition that we are frail, that we have moments of folly, that there by the grace of God go I. When we see another falter, we instinctively hold out a supporting arm. The prideful man cannot say, there but by the grace of God go I, because he does not believe it. He has overcome his weaknesses. He has disciplined his talents. He has overcome the financial and emotional insecurities of life. Why must he have sympathy with human weakness? He has not known the overturn of an economy, the tumult of war, which no individual can control. He walks alone in pride as if he is a god. Pride destroys love and compassion, and ultimately, pride destroys man himself. For what is life? Is life a broad highway, smooth and easy? No. Life is a dangerous path along a narrow precipice. Yawning on both sides of the path is death, disease, suffering, financial reverses, and loss. In life, we need support. We need to be tied by many a rope to family and friends, so that if we slip, others will shore us up and pull us to safety. The man of pride, he walks alone. One by one, he cuts the ropes which bind him to his fellow men. And when an ill wind blows and he trips, there is none to pick him up. Pride is the enemy of man and the enemy of God. What are the enemies of pride? Self-respect is one enemy. Self-respect and pride are opposite poles of a single strand of emotion. Pride boasts. Self-respect is deliberate in judgment. Pride struts. Self-respect walks modestly and humbly. Pride is the center of a narrow world of man's creation. Self-respect is part of God's vast universe. The man of self-respect condemns vanity in another, and he works diligently to root out pride from his own being. The man of self-respect walks with dignity, but without pretense. He walks conscious of his talents, but does not presume that his talents are of his own creation, or that they are of any higher degree than those of many, many others. The man of dignity is conscious of his responsibilities. The man of pride is only conscious of his responsibility to himself. Yom Kippur is the enemy of pride. Yom Kippur can be likened to a symphony. Like any great symphony, it has many moods and many movements circling around a central theme that occurs and reoccurs. And what is that theme? For we are not so presumptuous and stiff-necked as to say before thee that we are wholly righteous and have not sinned. But verily we have sinned, we have transgressed, and we have done perversely. The theme of Yom Kippur is man's humanity, his mortality, his frailty. None of us is perfect or as good as we presume ourselves to be. All of us fail, make mistakes, commit errors and sins. Each of us might be a better human being than we have been, and this is destructive of pride, is it not? For what is pride but a sealing off of the soul from criticism, self-criticism, or the criticism of another? Psychology has described to us the intricate defense mechanisms by which we create a zone of silence around our personality. We refuse to admit truth to be truth when it is a truth we do not wish to hear. We refuse to admit truth to be truth when it is a truth we do not wish to hear. Through this long day of prayer, must we not pray to hear this truth? Amen.